Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Right. Well, fine. Let's do a podcast. I'm absolutely in the zone. Oh, everything's firing. Brilliant. Hello. How are you? I hope you had a good weekend. I had a nice weekend. It wasn't a very good weekend in Kabul. I'm not saying that flippantly. Obviously, I'm against war generally. But I do think once you've started one, you should probably see it through. You know, you might not be a fan of invasive surgery, but you know, if you cut someone open, you should probably finish the procedure rather than just walking away while they just bleed out. I'm just bleeding out now. But it put me in mind of a song. We've got Mick Wright coming up, by the way. It put me in mind of a song. Now, I can't remember if I've done this on the podcast before or not, and I'm really sorry if I have, but I'm pretty sure I haven't told the story of it. So it was, I think, 19 years ago. I wrote a song for a review in Washington, D.C. I was living out there working at BBC America, cutting promos for Ground Force, which no one could understand. Anyway, I did a song called Sunday in Kabul. And it was sort of intended as a sort of a wry little thing. They turned it into the big tap dance number. And the guy sort of sang the main refrain, and then 20 tap dancers came out in like kneecaps, and it was all just sort of feet and eyes. And the thing was, it was intended as quite a wry, quite wistful in a way song. And all the Americans in the audience were going, "Yeah, hell yeah!" We showed them. So I went and watched it once and then slunk away slightly shamefacedly. And I thought, well, it's one of those songs that, you know, will come and go, you know, like when you do a parody of the John Lewis advert on the Now Show, you know, it has its moment and then it goes. But here we are nearly 20 years later and it sort of still feels relevant. And I thought, well, why not? I've blown the dust off my, French duty ukulele. I say blown the dust off, sort of wearily wiped the mildew off it. And still in tune, kind of. Do you want to hear it? I'll just do it. And you can always skip forward if you've heard it before. It doesn't really matter. Sunday in Kabul, just pack up your trouble. Take a trip down what's left of the street. Take in a movie or Al Jazeera on TV. Can you hear the tuneful whistle of that intercontinental missile? Sunday in Kabul, watching your skin bubble, walking hand in hand and heart in mouth. Wear your burqa made of satin. I heard Joe's got a fresh batch of rat in. Living fat on Sunday in Kabul. Monday, I'm no happy bunny. How I miss my honey, my amorous Afghani. Days drag by till Sunday comes. It's raining cats and dogs and bombs. And Sunday in Kabul, strolling through the rubble, having fun in the city that never sleeps. So eat, drink, and be merry. Watch for dysentery. We could go and drink martinis, except the bar was blown to smithereens. Sunday in Kabul, make mine a double. Somebody flew me to the moon. Beirut, Belgrade once were pretty. How often it's said of my city now. Don't they know it's Sunday? It's gotta get better one day. Don't they know it's Sunday in Kabul? I saw lots of stuff on social media saying a tragedy is happening before our very eyes. It's not a tragedy. Like, a tragedy is, you know, something like an earthquake that no one could have seen coming. We used to see this coming. This is an atrocity. Anyway, yeah, you don't need me to say things like that at you, do you? It's Monday morning, for crying out loud.
Every day the papers pump out endless streams of hate. The fifth column's propaganda they will propagate. But who can bear the traitor ramparts of the fourth estate? Mick Wright, a.k.a. Broken Bottle Boy. Mick Wright, a.k.a. Broken Bottle Boy.
Here he is. Here's the man himself in his salmon pink suit. It's Mick Wright. And what we thought we'd do today, perhaps, was a hit piece on Robert Peston, and then talk about the curious nature of hit pieces. Is that a good idea?
Kind of. Well, because there are hit pieces and there are hit pieces. In that, the thing that I've written about Robert Peston is very much focused on actual things he said and done. So I don't even consider it to be a hit piece. It's just more a critical piece of his really ludicrous novel, as opposed to, say, the hit pieces in the Mail that we want to talk about, which are about, you know, insinuation and bad faith, bad faith looks at people's lives and careers.
Sure. But I mean, I think we've done enough of these to know that I'm always going to go for Route 1 fatuous stuff. So you're welcome.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed your Peston piece. There's a slight noise on your mic, and I don't know what it is.
It's a microwave, which I think is going to stop in a moment.
Okay.
In like 20 seconds.
20 seconds is fine. It's fine. I don't want anyone eating any not piping hot food.
Eggs. Yeah, Peston.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. His novel seems to be a massive leap of the imagination for him.
Yes, it features a character called Gil Peck, who is a political editor of the fictional Financial Chronicle in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
Robert Peston was political editor of the Financial Times at the start of the Tony Blair era. His bosses mock his speaking style. Who could that be about? And is and the grimmest part of it is the character's sister dies in a cycling accident. Robert Peston's actual sister had a serious cycling accident but recovered. So
wow.
I'm not sure how I would feel about that if I were his sister. It's be like, oh.
Rob, mate.
I've been reading your book and it's a bit, I'm a bit dead in it, and I think...
Yeah, you know how all of the rest of your book appears to be like you, but sort of as you'd like to see yourself in a sort of idealized way?
Yeah. And the bit that I'm sure, I have not checked the Daily Mail yet, but I'm sure the Daily Mail will pick up on, is that the character, Gil Peck, is an absolute fiend for the old chisel. Because of that, Andrew Billen in the Times Magazine profile piece asked Peston about his own relationship to drugs, and Peston I'm falling into tabloidism there, says, yeah, I did drugs in my 20s and 30s periodically, but I didn't have a, you know, massive habit or anything. So, you know, expect Peston's drug shame to turn up in the Mail.
But I sort of feel like he's not even really necessarily, and I don't find drug taking interesting, but I don't think he's even that interesting. I sort of feel like because he wants to be this sort of bad boy maverick, I feel like he's just saying that.
I'm pretty sure that a substantial number of people who worked at the Financial Times in the 1990s, you know, availed themselves of cocaine. Such as I am very sure that a significant number of people at current national newspapers, newsrooms, avail themselves of cocaine. So, you know.
Yeah.
I put it this way: I would love the Daily Mail to do its thing where it, you know, goes, a swab has been done in the offices of such and such company, and it was found that there was cocaine there. I would love that to happen in its offices.
Yeah, we used a mop. Yeah, I've never done any of those drugs, and I think my main thing being that I'm just not that crazy about the idea of putting something up my nose that's probably been up another guy's bumhole.
I think that's a good premise for not doing it. I've never done cocaine because I have a massive overweening ego as it is, and I can't imagine how. I mean, I'm awful now, yeah. So how awful would I be?
Yeah.
You know, with that chemical enhancement,
I am perfectly capable of being overbearing on my own. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. I don't need any help. I'm naturally an arsehole. But yeah, so this Peston thing is interesting because it's. Of course, in the Times profile piece, it's described as a brilliant book. And, you know, look, I'd say this as someone who, you know, when I was a music journalist, we wanted to get famous musicians into the magazine. So what would happen quite often is, for instance, you have U2 on the front cover, and then curiously, U2's ropey new album gets 4 stars in the review section. How does that happen? It happens because you need them in the mag, you know.
Yeah.
So in the same way, I'm pretty sure that in order to secure this profile, they made sure to you know, big up the book, which they also had an extract of, and it is execrable.
it's your main contention is that there's an awful lot of telling and not a lot of showing going on in the book.
Yeah, I mean, the opening of the extract says, "All that interests me is the narrative, the story, and who controls it. As a glory-seeking journalist, I sometimes reveal scandals, but more often I try to find out what the powerful in politics and business are planning." And you're just like, this is not how... I've spent a long time around. I've been a journalist for 15 years. I've interacted with many, you know, national newspaper hacks, political editors and all sorts of people, and none of them talk the way that he writes this character talking. He is one, doesn't talk like this in real life. It's like, I said in the piece, it's a bit like someone took Raymond Chandler dialogue and then had it rewritten by an incompetently constructed machine learning algorithm. It's just like, it's like, oh, this character's hard bitten. And then you're like, yeah, but I've actually, you know, we know what you're actually like in real life.
Yeah, we know it's basically
thousands of hours
you.
Of footage of you, and this is not
being
you.
Not
know,
that. Not like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's really interesting, this kind of thing. And then, of course, he, like, has a kind of Blair analog character in it called Johnny Todd. And it's just very... the bit that really got me, though, is where he has a go at his character. Well, Peck, sorry, has a go at a political hacks who take dictation. Right. Now, this is the same Robert Peston who, during the 2019 general election, was forced, along with the BBC's political editor Laura Koonsberg, to apologise after they just literally parroted a claim from the Tories that a Labour activist had punched a Tory advisor outside a hospital. And of course, very rapidly a video came out showing that this Tory advisor had walked into this activist, but then it had been briefed by senior Tories that a punch had occurred. And I presume that they thought, oh, well, there's no video of this, so...
Mick, come on. In an entire career of journalism, just because they got found out one time. I mean...
Yes. One of many times. Well, it's just one of many examples I could have used.
But following your U2 analogue, his book seems to, you know, seems to be going down quite well amongst journalists.
Well, books about journalists that make journalists the hero are always... journalists are predisposed to go, yeah, of course, we are. We do speak truth to power. We are, you know, we are very much characters in our own personal thriller at all times, which is not the case, you know? And I use in the article, I talked about a piece, I talked about, compared it to Scoop, which is kind of unfair because Scoop is one of the greatest books ever written about journalism and the nature of journalism, versus, you know, Robert Peston's airport thriller. But in that book, War constantly, you know, mocks and belittles journalists and shows them for the, like, egotistical, vainglorious characters that they are. Of course, if you did that now, you would not get good reviews. Of course, journalists still say they like that book now because, oh, well, that was that back then. It's very different now. We're obviously much more professional now.
Oh, yeah.
But I've always had this, I have long had this issue with journalists, and, you know, being one myself, that we just have this this notion of talking about our profession as if it is much more special than it is, and that and allowing even the most ropey, clearly stenographers for government to sort of to imply that they're brave and they speak truth to power and they're effectively war correspondents wandering around Westminster, and you're just a bit like, not really. You're very chummy and pally and, you know, dinner party friends with a lot of politicians.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, Peston got slapped down, unfortunately, very well by Boris Johnson during the 2019 general election again, when he was interviewing Johnson and he said, before the 2019 election, it was during the Tory leadership contest, when he said to Johnson something to the effect of, what does it say about you, another Etonian, becoming prime minister? What does that show about, you know, how meritocratic the country is? And Johnson just said, yeah, well, you're a Balliol man asking another Balliol man that question. You know, and it's important to remember that Robert Peston's father was a Labour grandee who, an economist who was made Baron Peston. And also another little fact that I include in this piece is that when Robert Peston got his job at the BBC, moved out of print journalism into broadcast journalism, his father was concurrently on the committee, House of Lords committee, looking at the future of the BBC.
Now, God, Mick, it's easy to... Oh, anyone can join dots, Mick. Anyone can do that,
no,
mate.
No, and I'm not saying... I'm not no, even saying that there,
of course
that there
not.
Is a...
Of course.
That there is a correlation between that. But it's just interesting for Peston to, like, to sort of present himself as a kind of maverick outside of the establishment when he could not be more establishment.
Well, I think he's very rock and roll. I think he's very cool, and I can't wait to read his
beautiful pink suit. Do look up the pictures, listeners, because it's a thing of wonder.
What was it you described as some kind of Savoy? What was this?
I said he was he looked like your dad cosplaying as a chip shop Savoy.
Very good. Well,
and
that's
that in the
him.
Blue suit that he wears inside the thing, that he looks like a man auditioning for a show called Hawaii 5, hell no. So there you go. I'm very cruel. And as someone said to me on Twitter, I'm just jealous.
Of course you are.
Remember, I'm deeply, deeply jealous.
You'd love to be Robert Peston, wouldn't you?
I would. Every night I dream of being Robert Peston.
You wish you had
getting out a sentence.
A TV show with your name in the title, the right stuff.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's Matthew Wright ruined that for me.
Come on, you should inherit the crown.
You know what my show would be called? It'd be called Right to Reply. Start with me doing an angry Jeremy Kyle style monologue.
I'm going to have you
shouting at newspapers.
I'm
going
to have you and Matthew Wright double heading it, and it's going to be and like you go head to head, and it's called Two Rights.
This is why you are such a broadcasting veteran with this kind of format creation. You're the next Richard Osman, aren't you?
God, imagine that.
I don't think you're adequately tall enough.
No, but you know, I'm happy with just the format rights. Don't need anything but the format rights. Fine with that.
Yeah.
So Jess Brammer then, now that we've done
Brammer.
Robert Peston. She's been in the firing line, has she?
This has been going on for some time. It began back in July when the Financial Times broke the news that Kirst Egg, Tory MP's brother, ex-director of communications for Theresa May, sometimes GB News consigliere and past head of BBC News Westminster political programmes, turned BBC board member, Sir Robbie Gibb, was trying to stop Jess Brammer from becoming, from getting a job back in the BBC overseeing their news channel output.
How is your egg, by the way?
It's in front of me. I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, this looks delicious.
I could have sworn you took a cheeky mouthful at some point there.
I did not. I'm a professional. I know I'm a professional.
That's terrible. Professional. Eat your eggs.
So anyway, the Brahma thing is essentially that she was editor in chief of HuffPost UK, which, you know, was relatively left leaning, but really more centrist, if anything. And basically, their aim is to say she can't have this job because she's left wing, and that won't be the BBC being impartial. Now, it doesn't seem to matter that the current Director General, Tim Davey, is a failed former Tory council candidate, or that Richard Sharp, the current BBC chairman, was parachuted into his role after being a long-term mentor of Rishi Sunak and a massive Tory donor. That's fine. They of course, are incredibly impartial. Balanced. Yeah.
Well, you can trust them. And you'd be a fool to say otherwise. You can trust them. Yeah.
Sound right-wing lads, right? So anyway, what has happened is over since the FT broke that story, the Times then weighed in with, you know, lots of whispers from government sources. Then perpetually thirsty drink drive enthusiast Paul Staines of Guido Fawkes started, you know, rifling through Jess Brammer's Instagram and Twitter accounts. And it's gone on and on. And over the weekend, the Mail on Sunday published a piece which featured a box out. The headline of the main piece was "So much for the BBC's impartiality promise," based on just whispers that Jess Brammer may actually, you know, be getting the role that people thought that she was up for. Right. And then the Mail on Sunday claims that the BBC didn't go through the correct recruitment process, even though the BBC says it has, and it just hasn't named anyone yet because it's not done. But the real, real killer part was a box out which was headlined "The BLM Supporter with Toy Boy from the Guardian," which was just a string of very grim insinuations about Jess Brammer and her partner, Jim Waterson, who is the media editor of The Guardian, and it includes stuff like, you know, discussing the fact that they went through fertility treatment to have their son, naming their son, naming where they live.
Was it special kind of communist fertility treatment to make sure they had a communist son?
I believe it was by Marxists. I believe the son has a full Karl Marx beard. That's what I heard.
she wanted her son to be born with the full beard.
Yeah, so what you get is Katie Hine, who's the showbiz editor of the Mail on Sunday, affecting to be really shocked that people on Twitter thought the word "toy boy" was odd to describe a woman and her partner who is just 7 years younger than her. Mm. And then also going, well, why is anyone annoyed that I mentioned the fact that they had infertility treatment because she wrote about it in Graz. She did, but it was in an article about mothers during COVID, and the context is completely different.
Can't say anything anymore.
But of course, for the Mail, the fact that they've included that, and the thing is, the Mail on Sunday will deny this, right? But the reason that they've mentioned that she had fertility treatment and that she's, you know, recently had a child is not to engender sympathy from its readers. It's to say, oh, because it comes very shortly after the piece says she's enjoyed a 15-year career in television and online media. The word "enjoyed" is interesting as well. Like, she didn't earn it. Like, it was just given to her. But the implication is, look at this woman. She left it too late to have a child, and now she's had to have fertility treatment. That's the implication.
I don't think that's fair. I think the implication is, look at this woman with her unstable hormones all over the shop. She couldn't possibly do that job properly.
Yeah. And anyway, when you come down to it, the reason that Brammer and, by extension, Watson are under attack is for two reasons. One, Jess Brammer talked, was a very public critic of people who dismissed the notion that there was racism in the British media following the Meghan and Harry interview. And two, Jim Waterson broke the story about the domestic row between Boris Johnson and Carrie Simons, as she was at the time, which ended up in the in their neighbours reporting it to the police. So, you know, this is essentially revenge, just as it was revenge by Jacob Rees-Mogg to attack Jess Brammer in the House of Commons and on his terrible podcast, The Moggcast.
Oh, wow, that's a thing? Oh, wow.
That is a thing. It's a monthly
that's my
podcast
afternoon.
It does. It's really horrible. Because she came to the defence of one of her journalists who Rees-Mogg baselessly attacked, again, using parliamentary privilege to do so. So, you know, there are reasons for doing this. It's like she was willing to stand up to defend a journalist of colour who, again, was attacked by a government minister, Kemi Badenoch, slandered and attacked Nadine White on Twitter after Nadine White did the purely simple journalistic thing of asking her for comment about something. Jess Brammer, you know, defended her colleague, and this is what's happening. That's why she's receiving this kind of attack and being accused of being, you know, a rabid Marxist for the mere belief that, you know, black lives do matter.
Weirdo.
So it's it's grotesque. And I mean, are people on the left have been saying, well, look, you know, Jess Brammer was deputy editor of Newsnight at the time of the Corbyn Soviet hat incident. So doesn't she, you know, isn't it a bit of like she's sort of getting reaping what she sowed? But I don't think that's a very I don't think that's the right way to look at these things. I think you could say what Newsnight did around that image was wrong, but it's also right to say a female journalist who stood up for her colleagues shouldn't be subjected to this kind of abuse by other women in the Mail on Sunday, which, you know, and raising such personal things as, you know, her fertility treatment, her child, her partner. It's just grotesque. And it's very different from me mocking Robert Peston.
Very different, mate. A man attacking another man. I've never been one for, you know, audio piracy, but I do feel like one of us needs to download the Moggcast and then like disseminate it amongst everybody else, because I do not want that guy's hit count going up on iTunes.
I thought you were saying download it and cut it up in a like
I might do that. I might have to do that at some point. Definitely.
Yes.
Oh God. Yeah. Oh God. Oh God.
So yeah, the Peston edition of the newsletter came out on Saturday, so that's up and available to read.
Do check it out. It's a fantastic
and
read.
And the one about this campaign against Jess Brammer should be out when I've finished this and come up
and
with some kind of ludicrous image for it.
Eating your egg. Your egg.
And eating my egg.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. People should go and check it out.
I don't want that to become a catchphrase.
Eat your egg. Yeah, why not? It's some Broken
sort
Bottle
of,
Boy.
Like a terrible 70s sitcom.
Don't talk over the plug. It's brokenbottleboy.substack.com. Definitely the Peston article is a vintage piece. It's brilliant stuff. Go and check it out. Mick Wright, thank you so much for being here. They should follow you on Twitter. It's at Broken Bottle Boy for top Savoy analogies. And we'll see you next time. Oh, by the way! Did you get did you get the thing that you went to Northern Ireland for?
No,
you didn't get it.
Because I did not go to Northern Ireland because I had a fever 2 days before we were meant to go. So
oh,
I
you're
to
kidding.
Stay at home.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I have now recovered. And it was not COVID, but it was just some kind of horrible virus.
Oh,
so,
you poor thing.
We are going to Northern Ireland later in the month.
Are you
going
to get the thing?
Yes. Many multi-packs of Tatoes.
No. The thing.
The thing.
Get that thing.
Yeah, okay, good. I'm glad that you've got me on a watch list. This is really good. I say that, I've got myself on a watch list long ago, let's be frank.
Well,
okay, I will see you next week.
Yeah, okay, great. Okay, bye. Okay, bye.
Bye, bye, bye.
Mick Wright, a.k.a. Broken Bottle Boy. Mick Wright, a.k.a. Broken Bottle Boy.
Mick Wright there. Incomparable Mick Wright. Okay, great. We've had some emails. Thanks very much indeed. Malcolm has been in touch twice, in fact. And he says, hi, Jake and the Yapparatchiks. Not done the lottery for years after the initial thrill of being a trillionaire quickly waned. But recently I remembered all the hoo-ha about what a con it was and how a three-legged horse had more chance of winning the Grand National. That's a horse race, Jake. I know you're not au fait with sporty stuff. Than people had of winning £1 million. Now, I believe that many people have won £1 million since the lottery started, but I've never seen a report of a three-legged horse winning the Grand National. Odd, eh? Is there a secret Grand National where all the three-legged, and why is it pronounced always legged and not legged, horses race? And why can't we put a bet on it? And I bet, or I would if I could, that there's an extra super secret Grand National for two-legged horses where people win the trillions that have been rightfully mined since Camelot came into being. I think we should be told. Ever yours, Malk. As in, Malk got drive. Cheers, Cousin Davy. I'm adopting that as an additional mantra to Malk got drunk, which is my usual epithet. Thank you, Malk. And here's another email from, hey, Malk. Hi, Jake. Just catching up with the Yapfest stuff. And is the sitar song Zigernerwiesen by Sarasate? Heard it at a local posh festival years ago, and it stuck in my mind as something that it might be useful to remember. Nearly 50 years later, hurrah, it eventually was worth it. Another one of those things that stick in your mind for no apparent reason. Hope all's well in La Belle France. All is well. Thank you very much. Love, Malk. P.S. You weren't the first with Malcolm Powder. How I wish you were. Oh, God. Well, that was my asleep self came up with that joke. And so I'm going to forgive myself for that. I wonder if I can find this. What's this? Sarasate. Is he going to visa? Oh, no, this is an advert. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I dreamed a joke. Here we go. This is the one. Let's have a listen. An extremely small child with violin has walked out onto the stage.
Hello. I'm So Hyun. I'm 12 years old. I'm from South Korea. Today, I'm gonna play Zigernerwiesen by Sarasate. This piece is one of my favorite. I hope you
like it. Oh, I get on with it.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
She's 12. Oh my God.
12.
3, 4.
What a load of rubbish. No idea. Was that the one? I don't remember. I don't retain anything. Back to your emails then. And we've got one from Pat saying, welcome back. On Friday's show with Cousin Davey, mention was made of Prince's creative guitar theatrics, where he presented Prince's pulsating projectile proboscis for the delight of fans. This is a modification to his guitar, which allowed it to eject a certain amount of... Anyway, Pat says, I've never done anything like that to a guitar, of course. In fact, I can't even stand putting a sticker on one. But one Halloween, a long time ago, I dangled a rubber bat on elastic from the end of my guitar because, you know, why not? Then this girl sidled up to me in a rather confrontational manner and snarled, why have you got a rubber bat hanging off your guitar? My reply was met by a mixture of contempt and animosity. They didn't have any spiders. Whence she stomped off in a huff. Just as well I never tried the Prince thing in front of her. Cheers for now, Pat. Yeah, you can't do the Prince thing anymore. Unless you're Prince, maybe. And troublingly, there's an email from Hedy. Always good to see. Dear Jape, do you think... And I haven't read this ahead of time. Do you think it is a sensible thing to wear my iron cross and walk about town? No. What? No. Why? I know there are old people who still remember the war, but there are also young people who don't and might think it's a bit rock and roll. Okay. P.S. Do you remember Jenny Hanley from Magpie? I loved it when she said nothing and just looked at you. Okay, Hedy, I think Joel is related to Jenny, I believe. Is that right? Let's not go there. Let's just not go in it. Let's just walk away from all of this. Thank you very much indeed for your company today. Obviously, you know, not quite the full show you'd expect, but you know, I'm busy, man. I hung a door. I bought hinges, you know, and put it on. I was quite pleased with that, and used my masonry drill for the first time. I'm feeling pretty butch, pretty rugged. That's my life now. And my family's too. I've managed to recruit mum and dad, who are working like dogs until they drop here on what I promised them was a holiday. Turned out to be a work camp. Okay, take care of yourselves. See you on Wednesday. Bye.
This has been a Swanburst Media production.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.